Life expectancy content is for informational and storytelling purposes only. We are not medical professionals, and nothing discussed in this episode or contained on the life expectancy website should be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you're facing medical concerns, addiction, or any health-related challenges, please seek guidance from a qualified medical professional or a licensed healthcare provider. Thank you for being a part of our journey, and we encourage you to seek support from trusted professionals when needed. Welcome back to Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. Today's episode is all about relative experiences. We could have the same exact environment and conditions and have completely different experiences in that moment. I think people do this all the time. You're sitting in the car and you're both listening to the same song, but one person feels very differently about it than you do, or it brings back some different type of memory for that person than it does for you. It's interesting to discuss the same event from our different perspectives.
I think because we have the shared experience, but we have it from two different perspectives. It was happening to both of us, but in different ways. Mm-hmm. For instance, one of the first times where I actually accepted that I was sick, that it wasn't a hangover, there was something physically wrong with me, that the drinking in particular was doing something to me that was more lasting than a next day hangover. I didn't go to work. And I called my safe space. My safe space at that time was my mom. A mother has that nurturing effect. Our mother in particular is super nurturing.
Even our relationship with our mother is different too. For me, my mom has not always been the safe space. And for you, she is.
But when something traumatic happened for you, she was your safe space.
You're right.
So I called her and she knew right away by the tone of my voice. And she said, I'm coming right over. And she got there and she walked in the door. I was stressed. I was ready to go. I was just not okay. I couldn't get my head out of my hands. I couldn't open my eyes. Everything was bright and loud and I felt faint. And then I felt nauseous, but I felt so weak.
Yeah.
It was just wrong. There was wrong things with me.
So that is probably the beginnings of hepatic encephalopathy. Your brain starts literally swimming in these toxins. It becomes difficult to think. And it's not just brain fog. Every cell in your body is asking you, begging you to drink. But on the flip side, you're too sick.
And that's exactly the truth. I knew I couldn't. My partner had gone to work. He was my partner in life, my partner in drinking, my partner in everything. Now, the difference between the two of us is probably about 100 pounds. Right. Yeah,
I learned that the volume of drinking was different too between you both.
He bounced back much easier and my body just couldn't. Anyway, so I called my mom and she came right over and she got me in the car and we went to the hospital.
And you didn't know how serious this was. This was really the beginning of any understanding.
Physically in my head and then mentally. Mentally, I was coming to the conclusion this is more than just a hangover. You know, you drink, you get hangovers, you know.
I had at this point for probably over a year at various points been going to mom and dad and saying, this is a problem. This is not right. I'm really worried. And your partner at the time had come to me in tears one night saying, I don't know what to do. Stacey has to stop drinking. And so I had been shut down so many times in talking to mom and dad because they were just in complete denial. I was not so surprised that this happened. My perspective was relief because now you're with a medical professional and we're going to have to do something now.
So I'm in the ER. And this is in the waiting room. We're not even back yet. And I am feeling so not okay, but in such a weird, odd way. But on the flip side, I am so self-conscious about everybody around me in the waiting room. I am sitting with my head between my knees. I can't focus on anything. I could barely stand up at that point. It was like this big roar in my head. It was just too much. So I did end up getting admitted. And this was the first time the doctor looked at my mother and said, if she drinks, she will die. This was not my first time going somewhere with having these feelings, but this was the first time, flat out, a doctor said, if she drinks again, she will die. And this doctor took what I'm assuming is probably a good approach with many and said, if you come back here with these symptoms again, I won't treat you. And I did see that doctor again. Yeah. I did go back to that hospital. And I just remember this disapproval look on his face. This just look of disgust.
Yeah.
Addiction's not simple.
It's not. And this tough love approach does work for a lot of people.
I would assume it does. But yeah. Me, I am a different breed. Well, you're very stubborn. I am very stubborn.
Yeah.
And all it did was turn me off. And I'm not going to listen to what he says. You know, whatever. He doesn't know.
Meanwhile, I get the call from mom that Stacy's at the hospital. So she's going through all of this pain that she just described, you know, fear and what's happening. And I can't even imagine how scary that was.
I'm a person that stays in control most of the time. I'm very even with my behavior and the way that I project myself. And I was in zero control.
My perspective of this is I've been spending about a year trying to convince people that my sister is in real danger, like fatal danger, that we need rehab. For a while there, I've been Chicken Little, like screaming, like, okay, we have to get her into rehab. We have to get them both into rehab. They're codependently alcoholics together. And mom and dad were just, no, Jillie, you're way over the top. You're being overly dramatic.
She is dramatic.
I am. So we get to the hospital, and my perspective on this is relief. Thank God. Now people are going to see why I'm so worried.
And address it.
And so I made my very first major mistake at attempting to be your health advocate that day. So I go to the social worker and I'm like, okay, today's the day. This is quote unquote rock bottom. We're here. Let's get all the rehab paperwork together. Let's get it all up. She was very far from rock bottom, you know? But in my mind, I like being able to do action, right?
You solve problems.
I like to solve problems. And in my mind, I like everything to be upfront and on the surface. I don't shy away from conflict at all. I don't love conflict, but I don't shy away from it.
And because I felt so under judgment from you, it wasn't necessarily that I was ashamed of my drinking, because I didn't lie necessarily about my drinking, but I wasn't ready, not even close to being ready to lay it out on the table. Yes, I'm having 8 shots of liquor a night. I am having a glass of wine. I mean, most of what I drank was liquor. It was shots. 8 in a night, just one after the other, sitting around. I didn't go out to drink. Just me and my partner would drink together and just laugh and talk. And those are the type of words that you associate with good times. You don't associate with harm.
What I would like our listeners to hear from the health advocacy side is that you feel like something's happening. There's like an excitement around being able to do something now. Like, oh, we can make this better. We can change this.
It's all out in the open.
It's all out in the open and we can do whatever. And so I jumped on that with accelerative force. I came in with a bulldozer to a situation that required very little talking. And part of that's my personality. And part of that is also an extreme desire to want to help and love you and do what I felt like I could bring to the table to help. So for health advocates that are listening to us, if I had taken a breath, if I had thought, I already knew about addiction, right? I already knew things, not with you, but in general.
Family members
and a biologist. It's like, I teach this stuff. So I already knew that, right? So I got so reactionary and I got so wrapped up.
That's just human though.
It is. But if I was going to be the health advocate for someone or give advice to someone, what I would say is, if I had just taken a breath when I walked into that hospital, before I started talking to mom and dad, before I started talking to you, if I had taken in the situation, had I talked to you first before going to the social worker? But no. I'd be lying to the doctor. What are we dealing with? I'd be lying to the social worker. I'd be lying to these people that I thought were going to make this all better, when I really needed to assess the situation with you. If I had done that, I would have known, I think,
I was not going to be receptive.
That you weren't going to be receptive. And I wouldn't have wasted the energy on that. And I also wouldn't have made it worse between us, because I think it did make it worse.
For sure. It did. Alcohol is a depressant. It can be overused and just affects so many different areas of your personality. Now, like
escapism.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky in a sense, I should say. If I was going to become an alcoholic, I was a happy-go-lucky, fun alcoholic. I didn't drink and drive. I didn't do anything terribly dangerous. You know, some people drink and get violent. So it is a toxin, like you said, and it does affect people differently. So, I mean, I think that although it was like my first time and seeing mom walk back in the room after that doctor told her that, mm-hmm. and I didn't know, right, what he had just said to her out right. in the hall, but I saw her face walking back in and yeah. it was just like, oh God, but it still wasn't enough to get me to stop.
The minute though that I realized when the social worker came back out and said, she's not going to listen to me. I did at that point, and I don't know if you recall this, I did walk in at that point and I said, what are we going to do? What do you want to do? And that's when I changed my tone.
I wasn't receptive to it. I felt like I had this life with my partner and we were paying our bills and, you know, we had our own house.
You were functional alcoholics.
And we were living our life and I was going to work and everything was great. It wasn't frequent enough that I was feeling like this. And like I said, this was the first big time yeah. where I started, if I'm honest with myself, to rationally question what I was doing and the effects, long-term effects it was having on me.
And I'm going to challenge you because you just said everything was great. And the thing is, it was not great because your partner had come to me and was very concerned.
Yeah. I mean,
there have been
know.
Other issues too. What I want to point out is that
my alcohol-induced mind told me everything was
great. That's what I was just going to say, is that your recollection of that is going to be this because that is what this drug was.
And everybody I knew in my life drank. You know yeah. what I mean? Mom and dad, you, every person I work with, I worked in an office.
Our whole family.
I worked in an office. I would come to work the next day and, you know, the sales guys would talk about drinking a six-pack or a half a bottle of bourbon the night before, and they were fine.
Yeah.
They were perfectly fine. They had families and children. I didn't have any children. It was just the two of us against the world, and we could live this life and be eternally 25.
We have some conditioning, too. Our grandparents did cocktail hour every day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, every party that our family had, it was always an open bar.
Always an
there
open
was
bar.
Always, you
at
know.
At the firehouse, Christmas parties.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So back to another health advocacy thing is that we talked about how we have extreme highs and lows, and sometimes it happens so quickly. So the drive to the hospital that day, and this is going to sound odd, I was almost euphoric. I mean, I knew you were dying. I just knew it. And I also was like, we're going to do something. And it was just like the arc of the movie where everything starts to get better
crescendo.
Now. Yeah. But I get there. It's like, nope, we're not there yet. So the low of thinking, oh my gosh. And because I had been preparing for these moments, I had been diving into how to be a supportive person with an addict and how not to be. And I knew what words to not say and what words to say.
To be fair, like I really didn't have any experience of any person in my life that I recognized as an alcoholic.
Right.
Or a drug addict. I mean, like, obviously I had experiences in college and I knew people in college, but none of them seemed like they had a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't think I had a clear reference of somebody who wasn't like a famous person that had a problem.
And I had way too many references.
And it's way too surreal for me to even think that, oh, something like that's happening to me. No, this I'm just a normal yeah. girl. This is just, everybody drinks. This
right,
is no big
and
deal.
That's the societal conditioning, and it's also the denial, and it's all of that stuff. So that going back, that extreme low that I then felt, then after driving there and thinking we're going to be on the path to health and sobriety. And then the low that I feel in that moment. And I remember the helplessness. And that was probably the first time as later being your health advocate, but in that moment as being your sister is realizing, oh my gosh, she doesn't trust me. And why would she? She's not going to listen to what they're saying. Because I saw the stubborn.
Oh, yeah.
I saw it. And I don't have the support of our family because they really don't understand how serious this is. And I remember driving away from the hospital thinking, what do I do now?
Hopeless. I would say it sounds absolutely like a very, like listening to you talk about it and just look at it from an outside perspective, it sounds very hopeless what you're describing.
And
very
I felt like
lonely.
I felt like I just blew it in the most hardcore way. I had the one shot to do something and I just blew it.
At that point, I was first realizing that this was a problem. And you know what my singular focus was? To make sure I didn't get to a point where I could never drink again.
Yes, I remember you telling me that.
That was my focus.
That is very common. That is what Smart Recovery is born out of, mm-hmm. as opposed to AA and some other programs. It's basically born out of this idea that, well, if I can just get healthy enough to a place where I can have a glass of wine with dinner. And some people, because I don't want to speak for everybody, some people really can do that. But there is a point physically, biologically, of no return.
And right. When I say it was a slow suicide, yeah. I really mean it, because I stopped drinking every day of the week after that.
Like, well, you do all that bargaining, right?
Cut back.
We're exactly. only going to drink on the weekends, and we won't do liquor.
Bargaining
I'll just do
is
wine.
A perfect word for that. Yeah. And that's what I did. And so, like, I prolonged my misery, if yeah. you will, looking back, in that slow suicide of killing myself by drinking.
Well, and here's something that that you probably don't know. I don't think we've ever really talked about it. So coming home from that, I just wanted to turn it all off. I was overwhelmed emotionally. I was incredibly sad. So what did I do?
You drank.
You know, I remember that weekend as a bit of a blur. All I wanted to do was escape. I felt like such a failure. I had tremendous shame and helplessness. And I remember also thinking, I'm never going to get this opportunity again. And I really wanted to help. And I was afraid I had just completely blew it with everybody, not just with you, with right. mom and dad too, and your partner, everybody. Luckily, I had an opportunity again. I didn't fully blow it because—
Listen, I've been sober over 4 years yeah. at this point. I am post-transplant. I have faced down my demons cancer. And addictions. They are still here. They will be with me for life, which is yeah. why I don't shy away from these topics. But like I said, I can find a lighter side yeah. now. I can find the brighter side of it, you know.
Well, I do
perspective changes when you go through things.
I have something to that lighter side point. So I didn't really care for that doctor either, but I understood what he was doing, right? And so I decided I had to find a way to befriend this person a little bit because I was worried they were going to kick you out of the hospital.
I thought
and that was
so
it.
Too. Yeah. And it was I would have been okay with that. And I would have gone home and had a shot.
Yeah, it was really, really bad. But the social worker, she was caught off guard. So she, of course, being thinking to herself, oh my gosh, we have a family that's on board and all this stuff. Yeah. But what I didn't tell her was what she got, which was the brick wall that was you. Because it was me that went down there with my passion and enthusiasm right. and
openness.
Confidence and open communication.
You barely see a support system, let alone somebody who has a support right. system and they're willing to help.
And I even told her too, you know, when she started pooling places, I was like, yeah, that's a no, that's a no. We'll take this one, this one, this one. I had it all worked out. But when she got up to your room, even though that's her job, and even though they're very steeled, and even though they have to desensitize, I think she was getting the hope from me. Mm-hmm. And then when she walked out of your room, she looked like she had just been deflated. And then she looked at me, and I was like, so which one are we going to? And she's like, none. I'm like, oh, no. And then I felt bad. I had to apologize to her because I felt like I had to, you know, oh, no, I didn't talk to Stacy first. I just assumed things. And that's another thing as a health advocate is that you don't always know you're doing it, but we are always making assumptions in our head. And I'm not the one that has the brain fog and the extreme pain. So I'm attempting to think clearly. And it is a mistake to assume that if I'm being rational, that I'm going to rationalize with an alcoholic or an addict.
No.
Mm-mm. And you're also very smart. I want to point this out. So she's very good at arguing.
I am very, very stubborn. And I think I know best.
Yeah.
And I don't always
mental
know
chess
best.
With you during that time took a lot of energy and it took a lot of thought. And the other thing that did happen too that day for me, when the doctor was saying that, there was validation for me. There was. And I saw yeah. a glimmer of it in mom and dad for a minute. But they went right back to denial.
Because they found, I'm pretty sure, a very high alcohol content in my system.
Yeah.
My validation came much later when Julie didn't believe me that I had stopped drinking, but I had at that point, and we showed up at the hospital, and they found no alcohol in my system. Yeah. You swore there was alcohol. The damage had been done by that point, and I had cried wolf so many times, there was no reason for you to believe me when I said I quit drinking at that point.
Well, you've just exposed probably the biggest denial that I had with you, and let me explain why. Because, and this is going to sound so terrible, so I hope that we can find a way to express this properly.
Oh, great.
I was hoping that you had drank, because if you hadn't, it meant that your organs were failing and that we may not come back.
Oh, God.
That is why I was so adamant about it. Because
as a biologist, you just knew so much more than all of us.
If your blood alcohol came back at zero.
Right, but then I was like loud and proud. I'm not drinking. I have quit drinking. Why is this... You know, that was supposed to cure it all, fix everything.
Yeah, and that's when that is the moment for me that I realized.
You turned that happy moment for me into a sad.
I'm sorry, it is a happy moment, and I was very proud of you. It was weird. I was proud that you hadn't drank, but I was devastated because I knew that, oh my gosh, she hasn't had any alcohol.
Because
we're too far gone.
I had then, you know, developed a lot of my sister's scientific kind of feelings about being data driven. And so if I had lied before and said I quit drinking but really didn't and they believed me and then, you know, it was going to be this weird position where now I'm telling the truth but they're not going to believe me, then it's like, well, I have these test results to back me up.
Yeah. Yeah, the receipts.
Let's be data driven. Let's, you know, I'll prove to her. And so that's why for me it was validation and I felt good. But now you explaining it that way, it's devastating.
Yeah. And I don't know if you can recall or not, but in that moment when those test results came back, I remember thinking to myself, I have about 10 seconds till I can get out of the hallway because I am not going to keep it together. And that was something I always wanted to do, was have my emotions, but not in those moments. And so I remember it was taking too long for me to get out there. And at one point, I think I just turned around and faced the wall. And I was just, I have to get out of here. I felt like there was no hope in that moment. I really did.
Look at us now.
Yeah. But I also think it's really cool that we can have these conversations now. And you just had an epiphany about something.
Well, yeah. This is exactly what this episode is about, perspective.
Yeah.
And how the things you were viewing through your lenses and I was viewing through mine, both with your experience and background behind you and my thoughts and what I thought was best. It was my life. I could do what I wanted, you know, and that's where this perspective comes in, where it is not that I'd ever want to do it again, but if anybody can get something from this and maybe take a page from us as how, as a health advocate, you can maybe try to put yourself in that position and how as a patient you can try to not be so single-minded.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's incredibly hard.
Two things that bubble up for me with this perspective idea around this particular situation is that if I had taken a breath and just thought it through, but we're so
a heightened situation.
Emotion driven.
Yeah.
And that's human and that's okay. And I had to learn that that was okay. And I'm still learning that today. And the moment you do very unhealthy things when you're the caregiver person. You compartmentalize. But it is your body and it is your life. And as soon as we got to the place where we understood each other a little bit better on what role we could play for each other, that is when it really started to click.
Above everything, even when it's hard, as a health advocate, giving that support is invaluable.
Yeah.
Even when I didn't know that I needed it, even when I wasn't receptive to accepting it, my brain came around to the fact that you were then my constant.
Yeah.
You were going to be the person that even if I thought you were misguided in the way you were doing things, you were doing them from the best possible place because you wanted me to live.
Well,
and you knew how close it was for me not to.
I love that we got to a place where you accepted that my intention was never malicious. Because as soon as we got to that place, then it was like, for me and for you, you know, because it was so personal, it was so defensive and hurting. And oh my God, why would she not accept this gift of rehab?
And I was just thinking about my life.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to give up Ryan, I didn't want to give up my job. I couldn't take a month off my job. I couldn't do this. I couldn't do that. This was going to disrupt everything in my life. And I didn't think that the problem warranted the solution.
And you did not have the physical capacity to process beyond those things. And even though we were always communicating, and it was sometimes hurtful, but we've always been really honest communicators. I think even in those moments, it was good for me to remind myself, okay, what capacity do I have? What capacity does she have? But it's so funny how we went through this thing as such a team for so much of it, but we both still have so many alone and lonely moments. I look forward to another podcast where we can talk about how you can be alone within yourself while you're dealing with something that I was never without you at some points. There were months over a year of our life where I think you were stuck with me constantly.
Yeah.
24/7.
Yeah, but I look back on that now and I'm just like very grateful because I heard the flip side. I saw the flip side from my doctors over and over again and the nurses over and over again, how I had a support system. And I was lucky because more often than not, that person, that alcoholic, that damaged liver was in there all by themselves.
Well, unfortunately, when you have addiction in your family, there are points where people get fatigued and there are no points of return, meaning you have burned all of your support potential bridges. By the time you get to a place where you are open to accepting help, there isn't anybody left. And I just want to acknowledge that if you're listening and you're one of those people that either a caregiver that has just fatigued and had to separate yourself for your own well-being, or an individual who is struggling with addiction and looks around and doesn't think they have anybody, you will find people in the odd places. It reminds me of the people at the hospital where she got her transplant. Those nurses, those doctors, those people often become what I was to you for others.
Yeah, for sure. I cannot say enough good things about the University of Cincinnati healthcare system. They treated me like family in such a good way. I felt cared for. I felt heard when I had issues and problems. I wasn't just shuffled off. It wasn't just another day for them. It didn't feel like it was just a job to them. It felt like they really cared for me. And as a patient, I can say that that kind of care is invaluable. I had very amazing conversations and support just through the people that were working there.
And there's a flip side to that. We would ease a little bit for them, the little things, but that also meant I think it was probably different, like when my mom was there versus my stepdad or me or your, you know, because we were different energies, right? So, you know, like
my dad would get a little flirty with the nurses sometimes. Sure.
And my mom, our mom, is so chatty and friendly. Everyone loves her.
She shares a story with everybody.
She does. And she's like a kind spirit and all of this. Meanwhile, you know, I'm the militant sister.
She's about business.
Yeah, I'm about business. You know, you said you were going to change her sheets 15 minutes ago. Why don't you just give them to me? I'll take care of it. But the good news is over time, what they realize is, oh, well, we can work together. So like I enjoyed being part of your care. And they gave me a lot of leeway for that.
Yeah.
Eventually. Well, pretty quickly, actually.
Yeah. You were allowed to go get the warm blankets for me. You knew exactly where that was. The good coffee, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. And also things like, you know, there were times when, and this is a messy disease, and this is a messy... Yeah, so we'll get into some of those things, I'm sure. But, you know, we did need to change sheets very often, and we did need to do other things. And it was like if they had a full floor and they didn't have somebody that could get there in time, I didn't want her to suffer. So I just made it so that I could do it. I would prove to them that I could do it, and then they felt comfortable. So I would just show up at the little locker and say, can I please have another set? Can I please have another set? Most of the time that worked. Any kindness that you share with the caregivers of your person is going to come back to you tenfold.
It's easy to be nice and kind.
Yeah. And what I was not so eloquently describing is I was genuinely thankful for them, but caregivers at the hospital are so overworked and there's so few of them compared to how many problems there are that every little tiny thing you do is a way of saying thank you. It's a gratitude.
Just to reference back, at University of Cincinnati, the kindness of the care that I received there, once I got to 8th floor, which was the liver transplant floor, I was on a floor with like-minded patients, and it was pretty quiet, and it was very serious. But before I was on that floor, you never knew what the nurse, when she came into my room, what she dealt with in the room right before me.
Yeah.
And I know they're there doing a job, and I don't want to make things harder for them. You know, I was just very conscious of that. So, like, even taking it back to perspective, their perspective.
I was just thinking
their
that.
Their daily shift in what they do. It's very complex.
We're also saying that, think about people in the room. When you're sick, you don't feel well. And when you don't feel well, it's hard to think outside of yourself.
Oh, I was an awful patient in the beginning. Like, I was awful and cranky and rude. I had no patience for anybody. I just wanted to leave.
Let's be clear, though, and I think you'll agree with me, she's reserved her worst, crankiest, rude moments for me.
Yeah.
A nurse would walk in and she would be sweet as sugar. The nurse would walk out and, I mean, literally the devil incarnate.
Yeah.
And I understood that. But you know what I realized very quickly on is that, why was this happening? Well, it is another reinforcement that I was your safe space. If you could be yourself and all the things.
I still carry guilt.
I know you do. But I think for me, it was, I would rather have the raw and the real so I could do something about it than the fake. Because I was hypervigilantly, constantly watching.
I'm an excellent patient now.
She is.
I would love to hope that nobody gets to the point that I've gotten to. Because if you have, that means you've been in and out of hospitals as much as I have.
Right. And that, of course, changes your perspective, too. Well, I want to wrap up this discussion by saying that at any given moment, you can take a second and think about what is happening and what is my perspective. And you can also take a moment to think about what the people in your life are thinking. And I think if we just acknowledge that we can be in exactly the same situation.
And there is a like-minded goal.
Yeah.
You know, there's a like-minded goal to get the patient healthy again.
Yeah.
You know, you probably want to go about it in different ways, but if you can come together like we eventually did,
yeah,
that symbiotic relationship just makes things so much easier.
Yeah. And so, you know, you'll see the materials on the website where we're talking, and a lot of the writing that I've done or contributed has been around hope and grace and resilience.
Grace. That's a great
that
word.
Was what I was going to get at. This episode that we're sharing today has a lot to do with learning about grace, grace for yourself, grace for others.
Thank you for being so honest.
Well, and I appreciate you listening. I don't know if I were you, if I could hear some of what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, and some of it I'm hearing for the first time, and some of it can be hard, but I think that this information can be useful.
Yeah. So we're life expectancy, and we're sisters surviving and thriving, and we're still working on the thriving part. But what I really appreciate and want to thank you for is I have been waiting to share some of these things with anyone and holding them inside for a very long time. And I think for me, it's such a gift that I can say them to you.
Yeah.
And that somehow in my mind, it turns that page for me a little bit. Like when we were talking and I got in the moment about what that meant differently that you had or hadn't drank. I think there's a healing in that for me now.
Yeah. Just thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. I love you.
I love you.
Well, thank you all for joining in. And we are Stacey and Julie. And this is Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. See you next time.
Before you go, don't forget to visit life-expectancy.com to become a free member of our growing community. You'll get updates, extras, and soon a place to connect with others walking similar paths. Music for Life Expectancy is composed by the talented Ryan Brunn. And a heartfelt thank you to our producer, Kinsey, for making each episode possible. And if you're looking for something to carry you between the episodes, check out our Spotify playlist, Life Expectancy Podcast Season 1. It's public, curated with care, and linked on our site along with all of our socials. Thank you for being a part of this journey with us.